to us tomorrow. The word procrastinate comes from crass, the Latin word for tomorrow. In one study, when subjects made a shopping list for what they'd eat in a week, more chose a healthy snack instead of an unhealthy snack. When asked what they'd choose now, more people chose the unhealthy over the healthy snack. As St. Augustine famously prayed, "Grant me chastity and continency. Only, not yet. Tomorrow." Around this time, Elizabeth and I managed to get our two families to Kansas City for a brief visit with our parents. I'd been thinking about how scheduling could help procrastinators, and I realized I had another potential subject for my experiments. When I'd started my research, I'd convinced Elizabeth to be one of my habits recruits. Now I turn my sights on her husband, Adam. Like my sister, Adam is a brilliant TV writer, and like many writers, he sometimes battles with procrastination. Procrastinators can't make themselves work, often, ironically, because they're so anxious about work that they have to distract themselves from it. But they can't enjoy free time either, because they know they should be working. A regular work schedule can help procrastinators because progress and engagement relieve their anxiety. "Adam, how would you like for me to suggest some habits for you?" I proposed. "Like I'm doing for Elizabeth. You can follow them or not." "Sure," said Adam, sounding game. I worried that I was taking advantage of his easygoing nature. Elizabeth knew what she was getting herself into, but Adam might not. He grew up outside Los Angeles and has the relaxed outlook associated with California, combined with a very dry sense of humor. I remember one night when he and Elizabeth came to Kansas City just after they'd got engaged, and we were all going out to dinner with some family friends. Jamie asked my mother, "What should Adam and I wear tonight?" "It's very casual," she said. "Khakis and loafers would be fine." "I'm from California," Adam remarked to me. "Wearing khakis and loafers is like wearing an ascot." I, on the other hand, have a tendency to be a little tightly wound. I vowed not to drive Adam nuts, and I showed great restraint, at least in my own mind, by not immediately launching into a long disquisition about habits. But I did give him a short pep talk about the strategy of scheduling. "Scheduling reduces pressure," I told him. "If you write every day, no one day's work is particularly important. And when you're working, you're working. And when you're not working, you're off duty. Without scheduling, it's easy to spend the whole day worrying about working, so you're not working, but not relaxing either." "I know the feeling," he said. I suggested that he write from 11 to 1 every weekday. During that time, he was to write or do nothing. No emails, no calls, no research, no clearing off a desk, no hanging out with Jack, my adorable 3-year-old train-obsessed nephew. Write or stare out the window. "Remember," I added, "working is one of the most dangerous forms of procrastination. You want to use your writing time for writing only, nothing else, including no other kinds of work." I'd grasped this principle by accident. In my home office, I do work such as responding to comments on my blog, posting to Twitter or LinkedIn, checking Facebook, or answering emails. But when I want to do original writing, my most intellectually demanding work, I go to the library or to a coffee shop where I don't connect to the internet. This habit protects me from the pull of email, the web, and household tasks, and forces me to do nothing but write. I decide, I'll stay in the library for 2 hours, and then I'm stuck. I end up writing just to pass the time. A professor friend told me, "One of the faculty who recruited me told me that if I accepted the offer, he'd reveal the secret to how to be a productive academic. On days set aside for research and writing, he disciplines himself not to answer any phone calls or check any email until 4 o'clock. At which point he spends 1 or 2 hours only doing that. Also, once he started it, colleagues learned not to bother him before 4, so it's self-reinforcing. After some time had gone by, I sent Adam an email to ask whether scheduling was working. He answered, "Scheduling is the answer for me. This week, I had lots of meetings, but if I'm missing my usual time, I'm making it up later in the day. I used to spend the day gearing up to work and not always getting it done. Now it's like having an appointment. I feel very drawn to working during that period now in general. I'm not sure yet if it's the formation of a habit, my commitment to keeping the schedule, or a combination of both. When I had lunch with two writer friends, one of whom had just quit her day job to work on her book full-time for a year, I couldn't resist delivering a short lecture on scheduling. She talked about what her schedule might be, and our other friend added, when she's making her schedule, shouldn't she decide what things she won't have much time for? Like what? I asked. Like not dating as much, or not making as many plans with friends. Well, does she need to do that? I didn't want to contradict her, but I disagreed. If she makes a schedule, she can set aside time for all her priorities. I'm pretty social, the first friend added. I'm concerned about spending so much time alone writing. So make sure you schedule enough social time. The goal is to develop habits that allow us to have time for everything we value. Work, fun, exercise, friends, errands, study, in a way that's sustainable forever. Favoring work at the expense of everything else makes work itself less pleasant, diminishes quality of life, and creates a constant feeling of emergency. Also, what happens if a person sacrifices a social life to write a book, the book is published, and it fails? The price would be too high. Even if the book were a success, the price would be too high. Scheduling is an invaluable tool for habit formation. It helps to eliminate decision-making. It helps us make the most of our limited self-command. It helps us fight procrastination. Most important, perhaps, the strategy of scheduling helps us make time for the things that are most important to us. How we schedule our days is how we spend our lives. Someone's watching. Accountability. Tell me with whom you consort, and I will tell you who you are. If I know how you spend your time, then I know what might become of you. Goethe, Maxims and Reflections. To be effective, the strategy of scheduling often must be paired with the essential strategy of accountability. It's not enough to schedule a habit. We must actually follow that habit. Accountability means that we face consequences for what we're doing, even if that consequence is merely the fact that someone else is monitoring us. Accountability is a powerful factor in habit formation and a ubiquitous feature in our lives. If we believe that someone's watching, we behave differently. Deadlines help us keep the habit of working. Late fees help us pay our bills on time. Grades help us study. Attendance records help us get our children to school on time. When we believe that we may be held accountable for our actions, even when we're accountable only to ourselves, we show more self-command. This tendency is very marked. In one study, where people were asked to pay voluntarily for the beverages they took from an office kitchen, people paid more honestly when the price list was accompanied by an image of two eyes than when it was accompanied by a flower image. In Boston, when a life-sized cutout of a policeman was placed at a train station's bicycle cage, bike thefts dropped 67%. The mere presence of a mirror, which allows people literally to watch over themselves, makes people more likely to resist bullying, to argue their own opinions, to work harder at tasks, and to resist temptation. On the flip side, when we don't feel accountable, we behave worse. The anonymity of hotels and travel makes it easier for people to break a healthy habit or moral code. Using a pseudonym makes people more likely to act badly. Even the slight disguise of sunglasses makes people feel freer to break their usual standards of conduct. For this reason, it's often worthwhile to invest in systems of accountability. A chief benefit of fitness trainers, financial planners, life coaches, executive coaches, personal organizers, and nutritionists, in addition to their expertise, is the accountability they provide. For obligers, most of all, This kind of external accountability is absolutely essential. Another way to create accountability is to go public. In his memoir, The Writing of One Novel, novelist Irving Wallace explained, "When you are a free and independent writer, without employer, without hours or deadlines, you have to play little games to force yourself into the actual writing. For me, one game is to announce that I have finally decided on my next book, that I am ready to write it, to put my pride on the line." Someone wrote on my blog, "I publicly announce that I'm going to do something because I know the downside of people giving me crap for not doing it will motivate me to do it, even more so than any intrinsic motivation I may attach to the task itself." Another reader agreed, "When I tell people about my goals, I feel uber committed to them. I'm very careful about any commitment I make out loud because it's almost as if I feel there's no way out of the commitment after I own it." My sister Elizabeth used public accountability to deter herself from eating junk food, which is bad for anyone's health, but especially for hers because of her diabetes. When she started her new job, she made a point of telling her coworkers that she was committed to eating healthfully. Eating right was a particular challenge because TV writer custom dictates that the office kitchen is jammed with goodies. Countless varieties of muffins, cookies, candy, cereal, chips, and any other food that writers add to the grocery store list. All free, which makes the array even more enticing. Workplaces in general seem increasingly filled with food temptations. Many more employers now offer free food, not to mention the birthday cakes, treats served at going-away parties and office showers, Girl Scout cookies, pizza runs, leftover holiday goodies, vending machines, and so on. I asked her if she thought that telling her colleagues had helped her keep better eating habits. "Yes, because for me," she said, "declarations are important. I have to say, I don't eat cupcakes to make myself go through with it." "Because then you'd be embarrassed for other people to see you eat junk," I said, "or because declaring the habit somehow makes it more real?" "Partly I don't want to disappoint myself by not following through," she said. "Also, at this point, if I ate a cupcake at work, it would be a huge office-wide story. I am so on the record about not wanting to eat that stuff." "So that makes it easier?" I asked. "Yes. Plus, no one even offers it to me anymore." "Do you ever resent that? That they don't even ask you if you want it?" "No, that's what I tried to encourage. We get the most unbelievable food at work. Like we were sent these super gourmet cupcakes from the best bakery in LA. The first time I didn't eat a cupcake, I almost felt like crying. But now it doesn't seem like a big deal." Elizabeth is a public resolver, but for some people, public declarations actually undermine their ability to stick to a new habit. A private resolver wrote, "I have to keep my goals private or they lose their magic." Another private resolver added, "The more I talk to other people about what I'm thinking about doing, the less likely I am to do it. The more I work on a goal in secret, the more likely I am to accomplish it." The key, as always, is to use self-knowledge and to consider our own nature, to know whether we're public resolvers or private resolvers. For an upholder like me, the public announcement of a habit doesn't make much of a difference. It's more helpful to have systems of self-accountability. For instance, I have my resolutions charts, the charts where I track whether I've kept or broken the many resolutions I've made as part of my happiness projects. It took me years to grasp that my desire to follow these resolutions could also be understood as a desire to shape my good habits. In the same way, my up band keeps a record of my actions, and even though no one sees it but me, that information allows me to hold myself accountable. Another way to use accountability, and an approach that obligers find invaluable, is to team up with an accountability partner. They appear in many forms. A language tutor who charges for a no-show, or a friend who gets angry if he has to work out alone, or an instructor who insists on perfect attendance, or a coach who checks in with daily emails. Such partners can help protect a good habit. In one intervention, people who enrolled in a weight loss program with an accountability partner maintained their weight loss more successfully than people who joined alone. A psychiatrist friend made an interesting point about the difference between accountability partners and psychotherapists. In the kind of therapy that I do, I don't hold you accountable, she explained. I try to help you learn to hold yourself accountable to yourself. A coach holds you accountable. Then I wonder if some people need a coach more than a therapist, I said, thinking of obligers. Accountability to someone else is what they're really looking for. For instance, my friend Adam Gilbert founded My Body Tutor, a program that provides this kind of accountability. Daily interaction with a tutor helps people monitor and change their diet and exercise habits. People want to do it alone, he said, but why? I tell them, you get help in other areas of your life. Why not with this? An accountability partner doesn't even need to be human. For years, I felt accountable to our family schnauzer, Paddywhack. In high school, when I was trying to stick to the habit of regular running, I always took Paddywhack with me. She leaped with joy every time I put on my running shoes, and her eagerness made it harder for me to skip a day and strengthened my exercise habit. In fact, one study, admittedly by a pet healthcare company, showed that dog owners get more exercise and enjoy it more than people who go to the gym. Older people walk more regularly with a dog than when they walk with another person. Even imaginary accountability can be helpful. I'm a devout fan of the gym Inform Fitness and its super slow strength training method, and I've persuaded so many friends and family members to go that I'm their number one referrer. One day my trainer told me, "A lot of your friends think you're keeping tabs on them." "Really?" I was somehow flattered to hear this. "Why? I don't know what they do." "They think you know whether they're showing up." I thought this over as I suffered through the leg press machine. "Do you think it helps them to keep coming regularly?" "I think it does," she said. I'd become an accountability partner without even knowing it. But acting as an accountability partner can be tricky. I don't want people to dread contact with me because I make them feel guilty about some broken habit. Also, it's a lot of work to be a reliable accountability partner. Accountability partners often work better if the people aren't particularly close, or if the accountability is mutual, or if a person is paid to hold someone accountable. Adam Gilbert calls this the peer or pro issue, and he's very pro-pro. "People don't take peers very seriously," he told me. "They do better with a pro." "Because they're paying?" I asked. "Maybe people value it more if they pay for it, but I don't think it's really about money. A peer isn't going to tell you the hard truths. You need a pro." Sometimes we expect someone to act as an accountability partner, but that person doesn't accept that responsibility. A writer friend is an obliger, and she asked her editor to give her accountability. "When I signed the contract to write this memoir," she said, "I told my editor, I can only write when I have to turn something in, and I don't want to wait until the last minute to work on this book. Please give me some fake deadlines along the way." But he said, "Don't worry, the book will be great. You'll get it done, blah, blah, blah." He just kept being so generous and understanding. "What happened?" I asked. "I wrote the whole thing the 3 weeks before it was due. It could have been so much better if I'd started work earlier." Out of misguided consideration, the editor had refused to provide accountability. If he'd understood that my friend was an obliger, he could have taken a different approach. While individuals can be accountability partners, it can also be useful to join an accountability group. As Alcoholics Anonymous, Weight Watchers, and Happiness Project groups demonstrate, we give and get accountability, as well as energy and ideas, when we meet with like-minded people. For several years, some friends were in a thesis writing group. They met regularly at a bar to report on their progress and to hold each other accountable. "The accountability to the group really helped me get work done," one friend told me, "and it was a lot of fun." A better-than-before habits group would be a terrific way for people to hold each other accountable for whatever habits they're trying to form. A group might be made up of friends, family members, coworkers, or strangers brought together by a common desire to work on their habits. Members of the group need not even share the same aims. It's enough that they're all determined to change their habits. Nothing can replace face-to-face interactions. But when that's not practical, accountability groups and accountability partners can use technology to help them connect. Virtual accountability is less intense, but more convenient. Another way to harness the strategy of accountability is to use a commitment device. That is, some mechanism that bolsters our habits by locking us into a decision. We can't change our minds, or if we do, we're heavily penalized. The lowly China piggy bank is a child's commitment device, and adults may open a Christmas account which levies charges against account holders who withdraw savings before the holiday. According to legend, novelist Victor Hugo's eccentric commitment device was to order his servant to take away his clothing for the day. Left naked in his study with only paper and pen, Hugo had nothing to do but write. Many people will pay extra for a commitment device. Half of a popular snack item's loyal buyers said they'd pay 15% more if the snack came in a package that helped them control their consumption. As an example of this attitude, I saw a neighborhood gourmet grocery store cleverly exploit people's desire to eat less Halloween candy. When the chain store across the street was selling big bags of mini candy bars for $2.99, the gourmet store offered its own smaller homemade bags of the identical candy for $4.99. A customer paid more to get less candy. Cost can be an effective commitment device in other ways, too. A friend who goes to my gym got special permission to buy a package of 50 sessions instead of the usual 24 maximum as a way to deepen her commitment to exercise. She knew she'd never allow herself to waste that money. One flashy kind of commitment device is the nuclear option. A friend who enjoys experimenting with strategies of personal productivity used this approach to quit drinking for 60 days. He gave his assistant a stamped, addressed envelope with a check he'd written to an anti-charity, an organization whose policies he passionately opposes, with the instruction to mail the check if he had a drink before the time was up. "Did it work?" I asked. "Absolutely," he said. "I'd raised the stakes, plus I'd tied drinking to my core values. There's no way I'd send a check to that hateful group." "It worked so well," he added, "that my mother did it too. If she had a drink before her time was up, she had to give money to her grandsons to buy video games. She considers that a terrible waste of money." "Did she stick to it?" I asked. "Yes, and it was funny to hear my nephews beg her, 'Come on, Grandma, have a glass of wine. You deserve it.'" This kind of commitment device is probably more useful for hitting a limited goal, such as giving up drinking for 60 days or finishing a big report, rather than for tackling a habit change that's intended to last indefinitely. However, used wisely, it might help to jumpstart a long-term habit. All four tendencies, even under certain circumstances, rebels, find accountability to be useful for developing habits. Obligers, however, require structures of external accountability to meet expectations. Therefore, when trying to form a habit, they benefit enormously from oversight, deadlines, and consequences, and from the involvement of accountability partners such as coaches, trainers, personal health navigators, financial planners, personal organizers, friends, or often, their own children. Many obligers feel a powerful sense of obligation to be good role models. From the vantage point of our own tendency, it can be hard to remember how different the world looks to people in the other categories and how important the strategy of accountability can be. While I was waiting to speak at a conference, I fell into conversation with a computer science professor. A 30-second conversation established that he was, beyond any doubt, a fellow upholder. "I've been thinking about how to help my grad students be more productive," he told me. "During our weekly meetings about their papers, they often don't have much progress to show me. It's a waste of everyone's time. So I'm thinking they might do better if I get rid of the weekly meetings and just meet with them when they have progress to report." "No, no, no," I said before I stopped myself and tried to make my tone more reasonable. "I'm not sure that would be helpful." I gave him a quick overview of my taxonomy and suggested, "Getting rid of that meeting is something that would appeal to upholders like us. because we don't need much supervision and don't struggle with deadlines. But very few people are upholders, and many of your struggling students are probably obligers, which means they need more accountability, not less. Or else they're questioners who may be thinking, why do I have to work on this now? Why not next week? My paper isn't due for such a long time. Don't worry about the rebels. They'll do the work in their own time, in their own way. So what could I do? He asked. Provide external accountability. Tell them you expect to see substantial new progress each week. Give them milestones to hit and hold them to it. The more accountable they feel and the more they believe you expect to see consistent progress, the better they'll do. Then there's the problem of deadlines, he added. One of my most brilliant students does great work, but his grade drops because he's always late. Well, that may be something different. Failing to hit a deadline may be plain old procrastination. A due date is a suggestion, not a deadline. Or it may be self-sabotage. Instead of doing his best work and being judged, he does it at the last minute. That way, if he does well, he can say, I'm so brilliant that I do well even when I throw something together. And if he does poorly, he can say, what do you expect? I did that work in 2 days. It was time for me to give my presentation, but as we said goodbye, I couldn't help adding one last word. Remember, upholders like you and me don't need a lot of external accountability because we're accountable to ourselves, but other people don't see the world the way we do. I was reminding myself of this truth as much as I was reminding him. The best time to begin. Any beginning presents an important opportunity for habit formation because a beginning allows two powerful elements to combine, novelty and habit. The novelty of a new start wipes out our previous habits, and that absence allows new habits to crowd in. With a little effort, we can take advantage of this window of possibility to shape the habits we want. This section explores 3 strategies that take their power from new endeavors, new circumstances, and new ideas. First steps, clean slate, and lightning bolt. It's enough to begin. First steps. What saves a man is to take a step, then another step. It is always the same step, but you have to take it. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, Wind, Sand, and Stars. Some habit formation strategies are familiar and obvious, like monitoring or scheduling, but others took me more time to understand. As I studied habits, I slowly began to recognize the tremendous importance of the time of beginning. The most important step is the first step. All those old sayings are really true. Well begun is half done. Don't get it perfect, get it going. A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Nothing is more exhausting than the task that's never started. And strangely, starting is often far harder than continuing. That first step is tough. Every action has an ignition cost. Getting myself to the gym and changed into my gym clothes can be more challenging than actually working out. That's why good habits are a tremendous help. They make the starting process automatic. Without yet having a name for it, in fact, I'd invoked the power of the strategy of first steps as I was starting to write this book. I'd spent months reading and taking copious notes, and I had a giant document with a jumble of material about habits. This initial period of research for a book is always exhilarating, but eventually I have to begin the painstaking labor of actual analysis and writing. What was the most auspicious date to start? I asked myself. The first day of the week? Or the month? Or the year? Or my birthday? Or the start of the school year? Then I realized that I was beginning to invoke tomorrow logic. Nope. Begin now. I was ready. Take the first step. It's enough to begin. Now is an unpopular time to take a first step. Won't things be easier for some not quite specified reason in the future? I have a fantasy of what I'll be like tomorrow. Future Gretchen will spontaneously start a good new habit, with no planning and no effort necessary. It's quite pleasant to think about how virtuous I'll be tomorrow. But there is no future Gretchen. Only now Gretchen. A friend told me about how she used tomorrow logic. I use a kind of magical thinking to procrastinate. I make up questionable rules like, I can't start working at 10:10, I need to start on the hour. Or, it's already 4 o'clock, it's too late to start working. But the truth is that I should just start. It's common to hear people say, I'll start my new habit after the holidays are over. I've settled into my new job. My kids are a little older. Or worse, the double remove. I'll start my new habit once I'm back in shape. Tomorrow logic wastes time, and also it may allow us to deny that our current actions clash with our intentions. In an argument worthy of the White Queen, we tell ourselves, absolutely, I'm committed to reading aloud to my children, and I will read to them tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, just not today. The same tendency can lead us to overcommit to responsibilities that take place in the comfortably distant future. But eventually the future arrives, and then we're stuck. My father-in-law has a mental habit to correct for that kind of tomorrow logic. He told me, if I'm asked to do something, give a speech, attend an event, I always imagine that it's happening next week. It's too easy to agree to do something that's 6 months off. Then the time comes, and I'm sorry I agreed to do it. When taking the first step toward a new habit, a key question from the strategy of distinctions is, do I prefer to take small steps or big steps? Many people succeed best when they keep their starting steps as small and manageable as possible. By doing so, they gain the habit of the habit and the feeling of mastery. They begin their new yoga routine by doing 3 poses, or start work on a big writing project by drafting a single sentence in a writing session. As an exercise zealot, I was pleased when my mother told me that she was trying to make a habit of going for a daily walk. But I'm having trouble sticking to it, she told me. How far are you going? I asked. Twice around Luce Park, she told me, which is about 2 miles. Try going just once around the park, I suggested. That worked. When she started smaller, she was able to form the habit. Small steps can be particularly helpful when we're trying to do something that seems overwhelming. If I can get myself to take that first small step, I usually find that I can keep going. I invoked this principle when I was prodding myself to master Scrivener, a writer's software program. Scrivener would help me organize my enormous trove of notes, but I dreaded starting. Installing the software, synchronizing between my laptop and desktop computers, and most difficult, figuring out how to use it. Each day gave me a new opportunity to push the task off until tomorrow. Tomorrow, I'd feel like dealing with it. Start now, I finally thought. Just take the first step. I started with the smallest possible step, which was to find the website where I could buy the software. Okay, I thought, I can do that. And then I did. I had a lot of hard work ahead of me. It's a secret of adulthood. Things often get harder before they get easier. But I'd started. The next day, with a feeling of much greater confidence and calm, I watched the tutorial video. Then I created my document. And then I started my book. However, some people do better when they push themselves more boldly. A big challenge holds their interest and helps them persist. A friend was determined to learn French, so he moved to France for 6 months. Along those lines, the blast start can be a helpful way to take a first step. The blast start is the opposite of taking the smallest possible first step, because it requires a period of high commitment. It's demanding, but its intensity can energize a habit. For instance, after reading Chris Beatty's book, No Plot, No Problem, which explains how to write a novel in a month, I wrote a novel in 30 days, as a way to spark my creativity. This kind of shock treatment can't be maintained forever, but it's fun and gives momentum to the habit. A 21-day project, a detox, a cleanse, an ambitious goal, a boot camp. By tackling more instead of less for a certain period, I get a surge of energy and focus. Not to mention bragging rights. In particular, I love the retreat model. 3 times, I've set aside a few days to work on a book during every waking hour, with breaks only for meals and for exercise. These periods of intensity help fuel my daily writing habit. However, a blast start is, by definition, unsustainable over the long term. It's very important to plan specifically how to shift from the intensity of the blast start into the habit that will continue indefinitely. There's no right way or wrong way, just whatever works. I'd noticed something perverse in myself. If I feel anxious about the fact that I haven't started, I become even more reluctant to start, which just makes me more anxious. When I fretted about the fact that I hadn't sent out Eleanor's birthday party invitations, I felt an almost irresistible urge to put off dealing with them. When I took too long to reply to an irksome email, I kept putting it off for another day. That's the trap of procrastination, and taking the first step is a way to escape. If I dread starting a task, just making a plan for beginning, jotting down a to-do list, finding the right link, as I did for the Scrivener website, locating the instructions, helps me start. This first step almost feels like cheating, because I'm not actually doing the task I'm avoiding. But taking this first step makes taking the second and third steps much easier, because I've already started. For me, it's hard to make phone calls. Except to speak to family members, I put off making phone calls, which makes daily life more difficult. So I decided to make a new habit. Make the call today. I have to call eventually, and postponement just makes it worse. I note any calls that I need to make, and as soon as possible, I follow through. The call to the eye doctor about Eliza's dry eyes. The call to my accountant. The call about the leaky pipe in my home office. Make the call today helped me start a new habit of donating regularly to a thrift shop. I want to keep our apartment clutter-free, and I'd accumulated a cabinet full of things we no longer wanted. I live in a neighborhood with several thrift stores, and since we moved here 11 years ago, I'd been meaning to stop in to ask the store's policies on donations. Because I didn't know exactly what to do, the discard pile kept growing. Somehow, even though I knew it was ridiculous, I worried that the shops would scoff at my donations or tell me I was doing something wrong. Upholder concerns. But I knew that if I found a place where I could easily drop things off, I'd get in the habit of doing so. I'd never been able to get started. Okay, start now. Make the call. I got the number of the closest thrift shop, just 3 blocks away, and steeled myself to pick up the phone. And I spoke to a very nice man at the Arthritis Foundation. Yes, they accepted VHS tapes and shoes, but not books. Making this phone call had a surprising effect on me. Suddenly, I could envision myself dropping things off at the thrift store. And what was the worst they could do? Reject my box of VHS tapes? The next Saturday, I walked the 3 blocks to the store, spotted a donation sign at the back, and deposited my box under the sign. Done. Taking the first step is hard. And every first step requires some kind of transition. Adults help children to manage transition by giving them bedtime routines, cleanup reminders, and warnings of 5 more minutes. But we adults often expect ourselves to careen effortlessly from one activity to the next. I'm in the habit of writing a blog post every day, yet every day I have to gear up to start. Running activities too closely together makes me feel harried and irritable, and habits of transition help me to switch gears more calmly. I love my morning transition from sleep to family time. I wake up early, even on the weekends, because I never want to miss that time to myself. Other people have their own transition rituals. A friend said, I drop my son off at school. Then I buy myself coffee and read celebrity gossip from 9:15 to 10. Then I start work. Another friend explained, when I was working on my daily writing habit, I didn't think about writing. I thought about my pre-writing ritual. I sat down at the computer, put on my headphones, and turned on my writing music mix. By the second or third song, I wouldn't even hear the music anymore, but it was a clear signal that it was time to write. I've listened to it 267 times. Another friend said, I can't just show up at the gym and work out. There's a cafe there, so I take my laptop and work on my thesis. After an hour or so, I'm ready to exercise. Jamie has a transition habit when he comes home from work. He gives everyone a hello kiss, then disappears for 20 minutes or so. He changes out of his suit, sends one last round of emails, glances at a magazine, and then he's ready to join the family. Because I'm always eager to cross things off my to-do list, I often want to hit him with scheduling issues or chore requests as soon as I see him. Thinking about the importance of transitions made me realize that I should respect his habit and save my questions until he'd settled in. A friend's husband has a more idiosyncratic transition. He sits on a sofa that faces a built-in bookcase, and one arm flung over the sofa back looks at the bookcase. He calls it staring at the bookcase, she told me. He's not meditating or anything like that, and I can talk to him, but he wants 15 minutes to stare at the bookcase when he gets home. Regular bedtime habits can ease the challenging transition from waking to sleeping and help us fall asleep faster and sleep more deeply. A friend who works in finance and travels all the time, and who definitely doesn't seem to be the bath type, needs a bath before he can get into bed, no matter how late his day ends. I wish Jamie had a habit like that, because he really struggles to fall asleep. Habits cheerleader that I am, I kept pointing out good sleep habits, such as, don't watch TV before bedtime. Don't check your email before bed. It gets you all riled up. Don't stare into a glowing screen. The light will make you more alert. And let's open a window, because cooling the body down helps to prepare for sleep. He ignored all these suggestions, except for the open window. Finally, though, I dropped the issue. If Jamie didn't want to change his habits, I couldn't change them for him. I remembered a joke that a psychiatrist friend told me. How many shrinks does it take to change a light bulb? Only one, but the light bulb has to want to change. My light bulb didn't want to change. I had a problem nighttime habit myself. For me, and for many people, transitions often trigger the urge to snack or drink, and choices are generally not of the celery or chamomile tea variety. I'd fallen into the habit of wandering into the kitchen around 9 o'clock to forage, because even though I wasn't hungry, I craved a snack. The evening felt incomplete without it, but I didn't like this habit, so I decided to quit eating after dinner. I'd often heard the advice to brush my teeth after dinner as a way to quit night snacking. I doubted that this could make a difference, but decided to give it a try. Instead of brushing my teeth right before I went to bed, I started to brush my teeth after I finished tucking in Eleanor around 8:30. To my astonishment, this simple habit proved highly effective. My urge to snack drops after I brush my teeth. As I brush, I think, no more eating for today. That's finished. And that thought, along with the clean feeling in my mouth, helps to end the eating portion of my evening. Also, many years of nightly brushing have made me connect the experience of toothpaste with the transition to bedtime. By examining these moments of transition, we can make small changes that yield big benefits. I pay a lot of attention to starting, and also to stopping, because taking the first step is so important and often so difficult, I try not to falter in my steps once I've started. But any change can trigger a stop. Bad weather, work travel, vacation, illness, a new boss, a new baby, a change in a child's schedule, a new home, someone else is stopping. A coworker can no longer go for a lunchtime run. If I stop, I have to take that very first step all over again, and I very well may not do it. Stopping halts momentum, breeds guilt, makes us feel bad about losing ground, and, worst of all, breaks the habit so that the need for decision-making returns, which demands energy and often results in making a bad decision. Stopping is a particular problem with the habit of exercise, and for this reason, my yoga instructor doesn't let people stop. He gives a lot of private instruction, and many of his clients leave town in the summer. People tell me, "I'm stopping for the summer, but I'll call you when I get back in September," he told me. I say, "No, you're not stopping. I'm canceling these certain appointments, but you're still in my schedule, and I'll see you at the usual time on September 4th. If you can't make it that day, we'll reschedule." "That way, they don't feel like they're stopping?" I asked. "Right. If they stop, they might not start, but this way, they never do stop." Along the same lines, when Lori, my trainer at the strength training gym, left the gym, I switched to another trainer without hesitation. However, many of my friends also trained with Lori, and I discovered that for several of them, Lori's departure was a stopping point. Again and again, I heard, "I just don't want to train with anyone but Lori." And I noticed that this feeling seemed stronger among people who were more reluctant to visit a gym. One friend told me, "I don't want to go if Lori is gone. I'd like to do some different kind of exercise anyway, just for a change. I'm going to find something else." Now, this is a friend I know very well. Well enough to be very skeptical of this plan. She'll ski, play tennis, hike, and swim, but she hates regular exercise. Nevertheless, she'd managed to form the habit of strength training. "You're going to find exercise you like better than this? Once a week for 20 minutes? No shower, no music, no mirrors? Like what?" I pressed. "It seems like a bad idea to let yourself stop this habit before you're well started on something else." I saw her several weeks later. "What did you do about strength training?" I asked. "Oh, you're right," she said with a sigh. "I have to find something new before I quit. Anyway, I worked out with a new trainer, and it was fine." The fact is, while some habits are almost unbreakable, some habits remain fragile, even after years. We must guard against anything that might weaken a valuable habit. Every added link in the chain strengthens the habit, and any break in the chain marks a potential stopping point. For many people, "don't break the chain" is a powerful strategy, for the same reason that some people want to get the attendance award in grade school. It's very satisfying to have a perfect record. Comedian Jerry Seinfeld advised aspiring comedian Brad Isaac that because daily writing was the key to writing better jokes, Isaac should buy a calendar with a box for every day of the year, and every day, after writing, cross off the day with a big red X. "After a few days, you'll have a chain," Seinfeld explained. "You'll like seeing that chain, especially when you get a few weeks under your belt. Your only job next is not to break the chain." A friend told me, "I got in a bad habit of blowing off our 3-times-a-week staff meeting. Most of the meeting is irrelevant to me, but often I did miss a few key points. After one particularly bad situation, I made a rule. I'd never miss a single staff meeting. Now I want to keep my perfect record." Upholders find this chain approach very satisfying because they love to cross items off a to-do list. Questioners find it useful if they expect to find it useful. Otherwise, they won't bother with it. Rebels resist the notion of the chain, and just the name chain explains why. They want to choose an action each time and generally won't bind themselves. For some obligers, the chain approach is helpful if they develop a feeling of accountability to the chain itself. These obligers may need a form of external accountability to get the chain started, but once it's underway, they often can keep it going out of a sense of obligation. No matter what our tendency, when faced with an unavoidable stopping point, such as a long trip or a summer break, it helps to commit to a specific day to jump back into the habit, as my yoga instructor requires. Something that can be done at any time often happens at no time, and waiting vaguely for the right time to start again is very risky. Starting tomorrow usually sounds like a good plan. But the more tomorrows go by, the more intimidating it becomes to take that first step back. Another reason to avoid stopping a good habit is that, sadly, starting again is often far harder than starting the first time. It's natural to think, oh, I did this before. It will be easy to do it again. But often it's much harder to start again. True, taking that first step the first time around can be hard, but there's also a special energy and optimism to launching a new habit. When I've tried to summon up the same energy for restarting a lapsed habit, it hasn't worked very well. The novelty has worn off, I've remembered all the reasons I struggle with that habit, and it's discouraging to feel myself backsliding. A friend told me, I quit drinking for a month, and I really enjoyed the challenge. When the month was up, I started drinking again, as I'd planned to do. After a while, I thought it would be good to give up alcohol again for another month. I expected it to be easy, because it had been easy the first time. But I couldn't do it again. It wasn't the same. Indefinitely, or even worse, forever, is where habit change becomes intimidating. Often with our good habits, there is no finish line. We can imagine taking those first steps, but become overwhelmed at the prospect of never stopping. Am I going to meditate forever? It's one thing to resist a single major temptation, or to make a brief heroic effort during a blast start, or even to train for a marathon, or to give up chocolate for a year. But to trudge along with a good habit forever can feel too demanding. It requires a surrender, an acceptance of the way we must live to abide by our own values. Persisting with a habit can be particularly hard when the habit doesn't yield flashy results. While there's the satisfaction of knowing that I'm doing what's good for me and holding myself to my intentions, rarely do I achieve glorious outcomes. I found, however, that if I can get through this dry period, the habit truly takes over and proves itself by making my life better than before. I'd been wondering whether I should drop the habit of meditation because it seemed pointless. Then, for the first time, it seemed as though it might be making a difference. Late one night, I was ruminating about various disagreeable moments from my day, and the longer I lay awake, the angrier I got at the thought of how much sleep I was losing. Then I envisioned my most helpful meditation image, snow falling on Bethesda Fountain in Central Park. It sort of worked. So I decided to stick to the meditation habit, at least for now. Or rather, I decided not to make a decision about it. Habits are the behaviors that I want to follow forever, without decisions, without debate, no stopping, no finish lines. Thinking about forever can be intimidating, so the one day at a time concept helps many people stick to their good habits. A friend told me, I remind myself, what I'm eating now isn't necessarily forever, it's just for right now, and that helps me stick to it. One day at a time, even though I do plan to eat this way forever. Again, this is where deciding not to decide comes to the rescue. I don't revisit my habits. I just think, this is what I'm doing today. Trust the habit. I take that first step over and over and over. Temporary becomes permanent. Clean slate. There is no creature whose inward being is so strong that it is not greatly determined by what lies outside it. George Eliot, Middlemarch. Any beginning is a time of special power for habit creation, and at certain times we experience a clean slate, in which circumstances change in a way that makes a fresh start possible, if we're alert for the opportunity. Many people deliberately use the new year or their birthdays as a clean slate, but it can take many forms. The slate may be wiped clean by a change in personal relationships. Marriage, divorce, a new baby, a new puppy, a breakup, a new friend, a death. Or the slate may be wiped clean by a change in surroundings, a new apartment, a new city, even rearranged furniture. Or some major aspect of life may change, a new job, a new school, a new doctor. A lawyer friend told me, as a single parent, I've always felt a duty to maximize my earnings. Last year, my son graduated, and I realized I've paid my last tuition payment. He's grown up. Now, what am I working for? It was like a whole new world of possibilities opened up. Sometimes, a major change leads to a clean slate, but even a minor change can be sufficient. A change as seemingly insignificant as taking a different route to work or watching TV in a different room. Even an unhappy change can be a chance for a fresh start. A reader posted on my blog, "My husband died in November. I've always been introverted, and while I love people, I found socializing tiring. But after losing my husband, I was worried about depression and loneliness, so I made a ton of social plans. I knew people would understand if I canceled, and I thought that having lots of people around would be smart. 6 months later, I still make plans to do something social almost every day. It's a striking change, and it's really working for me." Another aspect of the strategy of the clean slate? There's a magic to the beginning of anything. We want to begin right, and a good start feels auspicious. Anytime I'm trying to work on a habit, I make sure to follow it on Monday, because if I start my week feeling in control and virtuous, I'm more likely to maintain that good habit. We can take steps to heighten the sense of possibility, of newness, the luxury of untracked snow or a new carton of eggs afforded by the clean slate. One person might begin an important habit in a place that's very beautiful, such as a grand hotel or the beach at sunset. Another person might make an extravagant gesture, such as putting a hammer through a TV screen or cutting up credit cards. Another person might transform a home or office by painting the walls and buying new furniture. I talked to a woman who marks the clean slate of the new year in a very literal way by tossing out everything in her fridge, right down to the mustard and pickles. As an underbuyer, I was a bit shocked by this, but when I pressed her to explain, all she could say was, "I want to start fresh." The clean slate moment is easy to overlook, however, and too often we don't recognize that some fresh start is triggering a habit change. Because we're creatures of habit, the first marks on that slate often prove indelible. We should start the way we want to continue. In the first few days after we moved to a new apartment, I started my workday with an hour of email and social media, and bam, this habit locked into my day with iron strength. Whether or not it's the best habit to follow, I wouldn't be able to change it now without terrific effort. In college, where I sat on the first day of class, determined where I sat for the rest of the semester. I now pay very close attention to the first few times I do anything, because I know those decisions will shape my baseline habits. To deviate from them will feel like a deprivation or an imposition. The strategy of the clean slate can help us launch a new habit with less effort. During law school, I would have declared it impossible to wake up and go to the gym. But without consciously considering the clean slate, when I started a clerkship, I made the gym part of my daily routine. From my first day on the job, I went to the gym before work. It wasn't easy, even with a clean slate, but if I'd waited a month or even a week to start this routine, it would have felt much more burdensome. I would have thought, how can I possibly get up earlier, work out, shower away from home, dress at the gym, and walk 10 blocks to my judge's chambers before 9 o'clock? A workaholic friend told me that she was starting a new job and wanted to work more reasonable hours than she had at her last job. "Use the strategy of the clean slate," I suggested. "Decide when you think you should leave the office and start the habit of leaving at that time every night for the first week. That will set your habits going forward. Leaving about 6:30 or 7 sounds good to me, she said, but I think I'll want to stay later during my first week to get settled in. Don't you think you're likely to continue the way you start?